Great honor to introduce our main speaker for tonight. This evening, we have Christy C. from Massachusetts. Love you too. It's really great to be here in San Diego tonight. It took me about a week to get here. I did the Western crawl. I started out and I flew into Ontario and hooked up with some friends out of Pomona. Where are they? There they are. Wait, where are they? There you are. And we decided, we went to Serenity in Yosemite. So I went from Pomona to Serenity in Yosemite with big trees and coyotes, and it was cold as hell. And then we drove to Las Vegas, and I now I'm here. And it's great to be here. And I'm wondering how my story is going to turn out. I feel a little schizophrenic. I went from the mountains to the desert with a lot of gambling and a little shows and a lot of shopping, and now I'm here at the ocean, and it's great to be here. I'm a product of Young People's and Alcoholics Anonymous through and through. Sobered up when I was 19. My sobriety date is April the 11th of 1988, and I am a product of the never took a legal drink, and I'm a real alcoholic, through and through, through and through. I can't tell you when my first drink was, I have no idea, but I have this picture that I keep really dear to me, and it reminds me of kind of where I came from. I was about 5 years old, and in this picture I have this big ass grin on my face, and I've got this glass of cream de menthe, you know, loving it even back then. And I believe that I came out of the womb screaming restless, irritable, and discontent. I don't remember or recall a moment ever feeling comfortable in my own skin, and I'm sure all of you out there understand that. I always felt different than. I always was searching for something outside of myself, whether it be negative attention or this or that. It was always something to try to kind of like fill that. And I can't remember when I took my first drink, but I remember my first drunk, and I remember it like yesterday. It's crystal clear to me. I was about 8 years old, and we were at my grandfather's birthday party, and we drank. The family drank, and they poured me my little glass of wine, and then I proceeded to go around the table to the other family members and got sloshed. Got totally sloshed, and they thought it was cute. Little did I know that there was this allergy that somebody was talking about early, the obsession, that compulsion that was about to come and burst through. And we all come from different backgrounds and places. I know for me, my household was like World War III. You know, like you were saying, because I had physical abuse or, you know, craziness going on in my household, did that make me an alcoholic? No. I used to blame my parents. I used to blame my family that because I suffered this abuse and verbal and all this kind of crap that made me an alcoholic, and it's not true. I used to blame my friends. You know, if you'd only do what I wanted you to do. I blamed my situation. You know, I was trapped, and I thought that made me an alcoholic, and it didn't. What made me an alcoholic is that I had that allergy of the body and that obsession that comes along with that. And also I suffer spiritually, and I didn't realize that either. You know, in hindsight that I've been sober for a while, what I recognize is that I was always searching for that outside thing. What I understand is because of Alcoholics Anonymous, I got this God. I have this spiritual life today. And that is what I was searching for. But what happened was that alcohol became my religion. It was the Alpha and the Omega. Little did I know that it would be the beginning and then it would be the end. And the damage that it did to me, I can go into all the war stories. You all know the war stories, but the real damage was to the soul. You know, I compromised myself over and over and over again. I used to have standards. I used to have beliefs. But when I put that booze in me, something happened. What happened was that nothing else mattered. All that mattered was that where I was going to get my next drink, who I was going to get it from, where I was going to go, what I was going to do, who I was going to do it with, and it was the focus. You know, I used to sneak down at night as a kid, and I'd be 11, 12 years old, and there was always booze in the house. And I would hit the refrigerator at night to calm that storm. You know, I didn't drink out of peer pressure. I drank because when I drank, I liked that effect like it talks about in the big book. It numbed me. I didn't have to feel all that crap. The only type of emotion that was allowed in my house was we screamed. We had a lot of anger. And there was a lot of sadness, too. But, you know, it was like it numbed that. It was the great eraser. I didn't have to feel that pain. I didn't have to feel that degradation that I would kept causing myself. You know, and I won't say that I was an alcoholic. Well, take that back. I drank to get drunk, you know. I don't ever remember just having one drink. I did. I drank to get drunk. Didn't want to feel. Oblivion, you know. And for me, everything else is but a symptom of, you know. I'm an alcoholic. I know that to the depth of my being. But you know what? I tried everything. Drugs, men, food, money, anything to fill that hole. And as it progressed, you know, it started out okay. You know, I was doing good in school. I did this. I did that. But slowly but surely, it was like booze became the center of my world. And that's all that mattered. It's all that mattered. And when I was going to get drunk. And everything else became less important till there was nothing else but that. And it was scary because I couldn't imagine what my life was going to be like without it. And during this progression, I did crazy stuff, you know, things that I would never, ever imagine myself doing. But once I put that first drink in, I never, ever knew what was going to happen. You know, it could be that absolute happy, funny drunk, or I would be screaming, yelling, and getting kicked out of places, and losing friends, and causing chaos, and it progressively got worse. I grew up in an alcoholic household, so it was absolutely crazy. My stepfather was an alcoholic. My brother actually came into the program for a while before I did. And then me, and then I had this crazy Al-Anon mother, and it was crazy. It was insane. You know, what's funny is I look back, and it was like, it was totally acceptable in my family to be able to drink. My parents bought my booze for me. They didn't want to know about any of the other stuff that I was doing, but it was okay to drink. They thought, well, if I drank at home, it was okay. It was fine, you know, and I was we were all living that alcoholic lie. You know, here we come from the little suburban family with the, you know, the pool in the backyard and the two cars in the front, you know, in the garage. And here we are and we look all good, but we're all dying inside. It's funny. Alcohol, it touches everyone. It's a family disease. And not only did my drinking affect me, but it affected everyone around me. And then everybody else in the house that was drinking, it was affecting them too. And we're all living this sick lie. And I knew by the time that I was 16 years old that I was an alcoholic. You know, I was drinking every day by the time I was pretty much 13 years old. And when I was 16, I went to my mother and I said, I think I'm an alcoholic. And she says, well, I'm going to have to get back to you on that one. I need to talk to your stepfather. And I told her I needed some help. And what's really interesting is that my uncle's in the fellowship. And he had been trying to get sober off and on since he was 17. And actually had a couple of years at the time. And so my parents knew about Alcoholics Anonymous. They knew about treatment. They knew. But because the denial was so great in my family, my mother went and talked to my stepfather and came back and said, well, we don't think that you're an alcoholic. We think you're just trying to get attention. You know, deflection. Deflection. Because if they had to look at my alcoholism, then they would have to look at everyone else in the family. There was no problem. There was no problem. No problem, you know, I was notorious for coming home 15 minutes late. I had a curfew. I was notorious for coming home 15 minutes late. And so, and then I just, you know, if I was going to be late, I just wasn't going to come home at all. So, you know, that progression and that pattern. So I was, you know, I was running the streets and I was going to bars and I was hanging out with people that I wasn't supposed to be hanging out with. And I was doing things that I wasn't supposed to be doing because I thought I was so grown up and so mature and we were just having fun. But, you know, little by little, I was devastating my soul. And it's just kind of like I woke up from this fog and I reached out for help. But because of this disease, it was ignored. And so I continue to drink, and I continue to do all the other things, and it continued to get worse. I didn't think that it could get worse, but it always did. It always got worse. And then, you know, they talk about in the book, they talk about the solemn vows, the solemn oaths, I'm going to quit. And I tried quitting, and I couldn't. And it was like this vicious cycle of not knowing what I was going to do, not knowing where I was going to be, not knowing who I was going to wake up next to, not knowing what kind of situations I was going to put myself in. And I was dying. The fear of waking up every day just consumed me. And I think that fear that just ran my life and the lies, my life was this huge lie. And it was so insane and it was so out of control. And there was nothing that I could do or I could feel that could stop that craziness and that insanity. Right before I got sober, I graduated from high school by the skin of my butt. And yeah. I really did. And it wasn't because I wasn't smart. It was because that booze was the most important thing to me. And the way that I passed high school was that I got A's on my test, and that was how I passed high school. But somehow I managed to score high enough on my SATs, and I decided that I was going to go to college. I was going to turn over this new leaf, and I was going to quit drinking, and I was going to quit doing everything else that I was doing, and I was going to quit hanging out with those people that I was hanging out with, and this was going to be my new start. You know, and I did really well in the beginning, but I was drunk 3 days after I got to school, and so I was only going to drink. That was my rationalization. I was only going to drink. And I did okay. I achieved these things that I thought were important to me at the time. I was president of my freshman class, and I made a 3.8. I made the dean's list, and I thought that I was succeeding. And then the big claw took a hold of me again, you know, and started. Yeah, and I started spiraling again. And the next thing that I know is that I quit going to class. I got kicked out from being president of my freshman class. I stopped going completely. And what would happen is I was up pretty much 4 or 5 days drinking other things. And then I would crash and burn, and it was like this vicious cycle. And I was so miserable, and I was so desperate. And I thought, you know, I'm not going to live to see 21. I knew it to the depth of my being. There was no way. And we all know what that feels like, or we wouldn't be sitting here in this room. We all know when we've lost it and just lost, you know, there is no hope. And God works in funny ways. While I was up at school, my brother got thrown into treatment because he got busted at school. And he decided that if he had to be in treatment, I had to be in treatment. So he actually kind of ratted on me. And I came back home. Oh, and by the way, I was born and raised in Houston. Thought I'd throw that one in. So I came back home. And so I came back home, and I started detoxing at home, which was not a pretty sight. And all there was booze in the house, and I was crawling the freaking walls, and my mother had taken my keys away from me because she... So I was kind of like stuck in the house, and I couldn't sleep. I was up till 4 or 5 in the morning, crash, wake up, pace the room, and a couple of days after I'd been home, she says, "We have this wonderful family therapy session for your brother." And I was like, "Oh, anything to help him." And so went to the treatment center, and it was an intervention. They had already started the commitment papers, and I had this weird thing. I literally, by the skin of my ass, got out of a lot of jams and, you know, used my womanly wiles. I know, not counting the blackouts, I know of at least 5 times that I was stopped by the cops. And they let me go, or they drove me home. And this was before the DUI laws were really strict. And so, you know, you bat your eyelashes, kind of lean over a little bit, show a little cleavage, and talk like this. I got out of it. And I'm fortunate, and I'm lucky. I know that I'm lucky. I can't tell you how many times I drove in blackouts. I can't tell you how many times I don't know what I did in blackouts, you know? And I didn't go to jail. And I didn't get arrested. I didn't kill anybody. But I was killing myself. Death on the installment plan. And that was enough for me. And I know that there are yets. I've been around long enough to see what happens when those yets happen to other people. And they're a really good example for me. And it keeps me honest about who I am and what I am. So I ended up in treatment. And it was a lovely 30-day program. I was the youngest person on the adult unit. They didn't want to put me on the adolescents because my brother was in treatment. We were actually in treatment at the same time. And so I'm on the adult unit. And everybody was so old. And I was so misunderstood. And I was, you know what's really funny though? Is that I was really angry. And I was really pissed. I thought, my life is over. No more fun. No more existence. I mean, booze had become my best friend, my lover, my higher power. It was my everything. and you're taking this away from me. You know, I love how treatment centers and psychiatrists diagnose you. They diagnosed me as manic depressive when I was in the treatment center. And it's like, yeah, I'm going to be a little pissed off, and yeah, I'm going to be a little manic. You take my booze, you take my other stuff away from me, and of course I'm going to be a little upset. And it was like a mourning. But there was still this like rebellious part of me. There was this rebellious part of me that this isn't going to work for me. There's no way. So I'm in treatment. Most people's parents kick them out before they get sober. Mine kicked me out after. And I had no clue. I thought I was so mature. I thought I knew a lot about the world, had done a lot of things, had been a lot of places, and I thought I knew everything, and I was clueless. I had no idea about what it's like to live life on life's terms. None. Absolutely not. Because any kind of problem that ever surfaced, what was my first thing to turn to? Booze. And just drink it away. I didn't know how to have a relationship. I thought if you bought me a drink, then we were getting married. You know? I had some really screwed up ideas. And I was willing to compromise myself. You know, I'm going to talk about the alcoholic woman for a little bit. You know, we looked road hard and run over. We have this look about us, and it really saddens me being sober now when I'm anywhere and I see that look. You know, I thought that I was so attractive, you know, and I got sober in the 80s, and I had the big hair. And the Tammy Faye Baker, you know, mascara upon mascara, and fall asleep, and I'd get the drunk hair where you'd put it, and it was stuck to my head, and I'd have to tease it out. And I thought I was it. And now when I see that, it makes me sad. It makes me really sad. Because I think about what I was willing to do. What I was willing to give up. That piece of me, that special part of me, just to drink. And I continued that behavior well into Alcoholics Anonymous. I would like to say that I was a shining example when I walked through the doors, and then I took every suggestion that you gave me. And I read the big book, and I went to meetings, and I had a sponsor, but I didn't. And I suffered. The good news is that I didn't drink. The bad news was that my behavior was exactly the same as it was when I was out there drinking. And that catches up with you. I would walk into meetings, and I could see the difference in people. And I would see that glow in their eyes. And I would say, they're lying. That can't be real. I will say this. The one thing that I did do, and I really believe that that's why I'm standing here in front of you today, is that I did go to meetings. And I had nowhere else to go. In Houston, where I got sober, they have the Post Oak Club. So if y'all are ever in Houston, go to the Post Oak Club. There are meetings there around the clock. So no matter what time of the day it was, there's usually a meeting on the hour. And they're open early, and they close late. And they had chairs and couches and snack bar. And so there was a place where I could go. And I think some of that started to seep in a little bit. I started to recognize that you weren't lying, that you were happy, that your lives were changing. And I would go into those meetings and I would spout the freaking rhetoric and tell you how wonderful I am and how wonderfully I'm doing. But I'm sitting there in that chair and I feel like a fraud. I feel like a fraud. I hadn't worked the steps. I was still lying. I was still manipulating. I was still conning. I was stealing. I was cheating. I was still perpetuating all that same behavior. And it sucked. And it started to overwhelm me. I'm sure it started to overwhelm me. But I was mean and I was really cruel. It was kind of like, you know, it was kind of like a television show of 90210. I hate you, so I'm going to get all my friends to hate you kind of thing. I didn't know how to have relationships with other people. And what it was is I was scared and I was terrified of you. You know, what if you didn't like me? What if you knew who I really was? What if you knew that I wasn't doing the deal, even though I'm sitting there spouting how wonderful I am and how the program of alcoholics works and blah, 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 blah. And you knew that I was lying the whole time. And my behavior was so whacked. I was searching for all this outside attention. And I'm going to relay this one little story because I think it's really important. It says a lot about what I was willing to do at the time. It was a Friday night, and I got all dolled up. It's the 80s, so I have my spandex on. Short spandex. 3-inch heels, hair teased, and it was like I was going to a freaking bar. And I stroll in. And I did this a lot. Because I wanted you to like me. Especially the men. And I continued to act out on this behavior. And I came home one random day. And I had almost close to a year. Now I've been living like this for a year. And every day was getting worse and worse. And I was just existing. I mean, if you lit a match next to me, I'd probably blow up, you know, so freaking dry. And I came home, and I had six of my friends that I had gone through halfway with sit me down, and they said, "Christy, we love you, but we don't like you. And you have a week to move. And we hope that you do well." And therein I had that little moment of clarity. What I was doing wasn't working for me. You know, I would walk into meetings and there would be meetings about God. And we have a lot of steps that talk about God. And I would get up and I would leave. Because God had abandoned me. God was punishing me. This was all God's fault, you know. Had nothing to do with my own behavior. Had nothing to do with what I was putting out there. And I was miserable. And I knew at that moment that something had to change. I had tried not working the steps. I had tried not having a God. I had tried it my way. And I was suffering. And thank God for that little moment of clarity. And I decided that I wasn't going to drink. I decided that even though all this stuff had been going on, my life was better. It was better. I wasn't putting myself into situations where I could have been hurt. Even though it was chaotic and there were times where the inner misery, there were still people somewhat that loved me. And you people gave me hope when I continued to walk through the doors. So I made the decision that I wasn't going to drink, and I found the meanest sponsor I could find. Somebody who wasn't going to put up with my crap, because I had a line for everything. You had a reason. I had an excuse. There was always a but. I'm different. I'm not different. I'm not different. I'm not terminally unique. I'm a drunk. And the steps apply to me. I tried it my way. So I decided I was going to try it Alcoholics Anonymous way. So obviously, you know, I'm going to start talking about the steps. And not just how it works steps. I am convinced thoroughly. I'm a firm believer in the preface and the forewords and the first 164 pages of the big book. I found that sponsor and we started reading paragraph by paragraph. And if I didn't understand something, we had the dictionary. But there were some concepts that were difficult for me to wrap my brain around. Responsibility, that was a big one. Being honest, that was a big one. But with her aid and her guidance, my life started to change, and it started to become different. And she started to instill some form of discipline within me in a form of commitment. And she talked about service, and this is how I got involved in service. My first job was at the Whitney Conference, and she put a garbage bag in my hand and said, go around, pick up the trash. And I was like, why do I have to pick up the trash? I don't want to hear why, just go around and do it. She used to have me do stupid stuff like make my bed every day. And I'd be like, what does making my bed every day have to do with staying sober? Little did I know it was about discipline. Consistency. We're going to hear these words a lot. And I started to change. And my life became different. And I found a God. And that was real different. I started to trust in something greater than myself. What I've learned from the book is not only do I suffer from an allergy of the body and then obsession of the mind and that disease of perception, but I am diseased spiritually. And it changed for me, and it was gradual. I borrowed an old-timer's, God. I borrowed an old-timer's God, and I would pray to Dick's God. And I'd be like, I don't know what I'm praying to, but my sponsors tell me I have to pray, so I'm praying. Okay, help me keep sober, and thank you, and blah, blah, blah. And what's interesting is that as I progressed with the steps, and I took an inventory, and that was interesting. I started to believe something changed. I was no longer praying to Dick's God. I was just praying, yeah? And my life started to turn around. And things became really different for me. I was no longer seeking because I started to have it within inside. What's interesting is that I would like to say that everything's been hunky-dory, my sobriety. You know, I think that when I got sober, you know, after I started working the steps for a while and things got a little different, I thought that life was going to be great and there wasn't going to be any problems. And then I was going to skate through and, you know, everything was going to be roses and I've worked the steps and I have a God and I'm in AA and it didn't happen that way. Life happens. But what's really great is that the Book of Alcoholics Anonymous gave me tools to deal with life on life's terms. And it gives clear-cut directions. And even those who aren't familiar, if you pick up the book, it tells me exactly what to do with my anger. It tells me exactly what to do with my resentments. It tells me that I'm selfish and self-centered. I am not. Yes, I am. And it tells me how to deal with any problem. And so I was given these tools. And then I had a big problem. At 3 years sober, I got really sick. And I started bouncing in and out of hospitals, and they didn't know what was wrong with me. And I was having bone marrow biopsies and blood tests galore, upper GIs and lower GIs, and I was just deathly ill, and I couldn't understand why. And then finally, changed doctors, and I was diagnosed with three diseases in the lupus family. And I was dying at that point. And they put me on extensive chemotherapy, and I remember being so pissed. I was like, damn, I get sober, and I work my ass off, and I've gotten to this point, and I've worked so hard, and my life's changing, and things are getting better, and here I am. But you know what? It gave me that determination, being sober. I don't know if I would have made it through all that if I had been drinking. But it gave me that determination to muddle through. And especially the people in Alcoholics Anonymous. When I was feeling down and lowest at any given point, the phone would ring. Somebody would come by. I started to develop this network. You know, one of my biggest fears was being alone. And I was willing to do anything not to be alone. But what happened, because of the steps and my sponsor, and I believe that having a higher power in my life, and in this program, I never have to be alone again. And I was not alone. And I made it through. You know, stuff happens. You know, I got married, I got divorced, I went to school, I graduated, you know, I got married again, and, you know, life continues to happen. And it's wonderful. I know that I am so blessed, and I don't take that for granted. You know, I do the same exact things today that I did when I started what I call started over in that after that first year. You know, I go to meetings at least 3 a week. I work with other people. I have a sponsor. I'm continually in the book. And the one thing that I do know, and then I talk a lot about, is that I can't let the good things that AA has given me get in the way of AA. I know what my number one priority today is, and that's my sobriety. Because anything else that I have in my life, whether it be my husband, whether it be my friends, whether it be anything, you know, the car, whatever, all that would be gone in a heartbeat if I started drinking again. So I have to remember what my priority is, and I can't put anything else before that. Because I'm real quick. You know, that disease is waiting for me. It's subtle. You know, it's lurking back there. It wants me to drink. It wants me to get crazy. You know, it wants me to die. I know that if I took a drink, it's playing Russian roulette with my life. It's playing Russian roulette. You know, there's no telling what's going to happen. And I'm not willing to take that chance. I'm not. I know that I have everything to gain if I stay sober. Everything. The world is my oyster. There are things that I can achieve that are beyond me. And I know that. And I have everything to lose if I drink. I've seen it time and time again. People come in, they get happy, they get jobs, you know, life's good. And the next thing you know, they're drinking again. And that's scary to me. I have to keep my disease in perspective. And I'm not willing to compromise that. The difference today is that I know who I am. That's what Alcoholics Anonymous has given me. I am comfortable in my own skin today. I walk with grace and dignity. I am a woman of worth. I no longer compromise myself. I no longer have to be that person that I was. I'm intrinsically different because of a higher power, because I have had that spiritual awakening as the result of the steps. I am different. And I am so blessed. I have people that love me and that care about me. And I have all those things that I wanted unconditionally, no strings attached. And I found that through Alcoholics Anonymous. I have a life worth living today. I'm happy, joyous, and free. You know, it's not to say that shit doesn't happen. You know, there are times that I still throw my temper tantrums and that I beat my spoon on my high chair. But what's different is that my definition of insanity has changed. It is not doing the same thing over and over again, expecting different results. It's doing the same thing over and over again, knowing exactly what's going to happen. And that's because I know my stuff. I've done an inventory. I know what my character defects are. I have choices today. You know, I can decide to make that decision based on self and suffer the consequences. And that's my responsibility. It's no one else's. It's not the man. It's not this. It's not that. It's mine. And I have to own it. And what's great is that today I have the ability to think things all the way through to decide whether or not I'm going to do that or not. You know, and some days I'm willing to gamble. I'm willing to gamble that. But when the stuff hits the fan, there's no one else to blame. But the good news is I know what to do with it. I know where it goes. I know the proper place. You know, the steps help me deal with that on a daily basis. And I'm so excited to be here. Young people is an amazing thing. I still continue to go to a young people's meeting every week. I still continue in some way or another to be of service to young people's. You are my peers. I know you. I may be 34, which is hard to swallow. I look good, don't I? preserved, pickled well. But it's important. It's important to me not to walk away. A lot of people walk away after they've gotten sober in young people's, and you wonder where they are. You wonder where they went. And I know for me, when I come to these conferences, and I go to a lot of young people's conferences, that I see myself. I'm able to talk to people. I remember. I'm able to give back. But God knows y'all give back to me, you know? And you help me stay sober. And this is such a great place to be. The energy is off the chain. I'm fed in these types of atmospheres that I'm never fed anywhere else. And it makes me excited to be sober. It makes me want to stay sober. The fellowship in young people's freaking rocks, and I don't care what they say. And I hope that when, you know, I'm 65 and I will have some glitter, I've decided I will switch to sequins. And I'll start wearing those high heels, and I'll have that big hair again. You know, then I'm still coming. Then I'm still coming. And I love you guys. Thank you so much for being here for me.